This is a painful declaration of independence.
Hello, my name is Barbie Asante and I am a London-based artist, curator and writer. Since 2017, I've been working on Declaration of Independence, an ongoing performance forum bringing together women of colour to reflect on how the political affects the personal and how the social and cultural implications of historic declarations, policies and legislations impact on people's everyday lives. Between December of 2019 and January of 2020, Declaration of Independence went to Norway, to Bergen Kunsthal, a contemporary art museum in the centre of the city of Bergen. There, I did a series of workshops with longtime Declaration of Independence collaborator Feluke Taylor.
It's not about changing
We worked with about 20 women of colour living and working in Bergen, who came and shared time and food and stories, resulting in pieces about their lives and experiences of living in Norway. That was quite an experience. So we're going to reflect a bit on bringing together the Declaration of Independence at Bergen Kunsthal that happened in January. Over the course of this podcast, you will hear from some of the women who shared their time and stories with us, and also extracts from the performance at Bergen Kunsthal. The Declaration of Independence, of course, it draws the title from the American document, a document which is called the Declaration of Independence. But of course, there have been several different declarations, you know, and I sort of bring to the study of this everything from the American one to the declarations that the Zapatistas made. Initially, it came from a poem by Ama Ataedu, which is called, actually, as always, A Painful Declaration of Independence. This is where Ama writes about a kind of separation from colonial ruler in a kind of metaphoric sense, separation between genders, between man, woman, between black, white, and a space for Ama, because the poem is written for Ama. When I'm thinking through that, I'm thinking about this kind of this metaphoric space which allows space for women, or these women, to be able to kind of declare themselves, to presence themselves, to tell their stories.
Well, one of the things that I'm interested in and like to work with is the idea of collective narrative documents, which are kind of living documents, which are gatherings of stories that don't necessarily belong to one person and is not necessarily a single author, but speak to a reality and can speak to other people at a different time of that reality. And then they also, other groups maybe of women in this context, get to respond to that text and add to that text and weave in their own experience to that text so that it kind of lives. You know, too often archives are kind of dead places, aren't they, where things go to get dusty. If things can be reincarnated through our bodies and through the bodies of different women, all kinds of things can happen. So one of the things I've been doing is drawing out from the scripts of various performances, quotes and ideas, which we are going to use as writing prompts so that other groups of women and other declarations, hopefully, can riff off of and feel the spirit of what has gone before and who has gone before, so that we kind of somehow remain in connection, you know, and are more than just our single one selves.
My name is Meju Rabela. I'm an art historian, and I come from Argentina, and I live in Oslo in Norway. I have two kids and a lovely husband, and I'm the director of an artist-run space called Penthouse in Oslo. I was delivered like a package of otherness that somebody decided that I was going to have. And I started university and I thought it was me. So everything of my weirdness and Latinoness and everything, I start getting rid of those things. And I just dedicated myself to study, and I finished my bachelor and my master's reading and studying and avoiding a lot of things, the society in a way. It was very tough.
I remember you thinking my name was so strange. I knew you wouldn't remember it. I know you think you know me. I remember you talking about the time you lived in Latin America for those 2 months in a language course. I remember you saying, you people, the Latinos, in Latin America, one does or doesn't. I know you don't know much, and you might have done a lot of sightseeing, but it does not count for commenting in for continent, nor country, a city, neighborhood, or street. I know you don't know much about my country. I know you won't change your judgments. I remember you saying it was a sad place and I should be happy, feel lucky to live here. I know you will never understand why I'm not or should not. I know you want to have this in common.
Those first years with the people saying I've been doing all South America, it was just a reaction of, how can you think that you know a continent just for being a tourist? And they asked the most ridiculous question. It was just the most stupid questions, like, do you eat bread? Do you know Maria Perez from Ecuador? Like, Argentina and Ecuador are... Or do you always wear lingerie, you know, Latino, dancing salsa? I was disappointed and I was very hurt. I let go of the package that I was delivered at 20 when I came with this otherness that I got. I didn't want that. And I'm going to work every day to tell people who are getting these packages that they have a choice to say, no, thank you, I'm good, I don't need this. It is something that the structure gives you when you come here. I don't know how it is for people who are born here, but for me personally and the people who are migrating here, I really want them to understand that they, when they come here, they don't come empty. It's not only us who are coming here who have to integrate to the Norwegian society, because that's what I did. I just got rid of everything that make me myself, and I didn't manage to integrate. So it doesn't work like that way. If we are going to integrate and then I want the Norwegian society to understand that they have to open up too, because we don't share the past. I don't share the past with the Norwegians. But I might share the future if they let me. I would love very much to be part of the building of the future of the place that I've decided to be and live and have my kids. And if they don't let us and if they don't make space for us, then I will crack it open. I'm not waiting anymore and I'm not asking for permission.
The togetherness is really important, because actually the Declaration of Independence is not a declaration of independence as in, you know, unilateral on your own kind of thing. It is a declaration of interdependence. As soon as you meet, there is the door is open, and you know, as soon as we sit down to dinner, the door is open, the laughs are coming in, the pain, the experiences, the kind of, you know, some people arrived at this dinner, a couple of people who we never saw again, but it was just, that is part of, they are included in the project. The fact that we go to a performance, the performance is an output for everyone. Of course, there are people that perform in that, but it's the space for everyone. We are speaking in the tongues of all of the women that have been part of that, and also women probably that have been part of our lives before. This circle is our circle. It's our process. This is our process. And what we do might change. What we do is really in service of whatever's coming up into the room. So I often describe the work as ritual, because a ritual will allow space for whatever comes up.
Yeah, I think a ritual just requires the setting of space and then the seeing what happens. And I think what really strikes me each time in each declaration is how willing women are to bring themselves to this space, to do things which are they've never tried before, which are unusual, to move in particular way, to drink the tea that we brew. Maybe it's a small thing, but I think when you've got a group of maybe about 20 women and we made our sorrel and ginger hibiscus tea with ginger and cinnamon, and everybody drank it. People really want to be together and to join and try and cry, of course. And the ritual of the tea is another example of things happen that you didn't plan for. We had to have, you know, enough for everybody. So we found these small cups. And as I poured the tea and took it round, one of them was leaking. And I didn't realise, so it kind of literally just dripped this red tea all over everywhere. And that became kind of a bit of a theme for me as I was, you know, writing and working with other women on writing. I kept thinking about what it means that this tea spilt, this one cup. Yeah, our offering to the ancestors, you know. And again, it was something that opened up a whole discussion about traditions and various practices that have been handed down through grandmothers and aunts and mothers and sisters. So the spill spilled, if you like, throughout.
Spill the tea. I pour the tea into cups, one for each of us, and an extra one that is cracked and leaks. Tea spills for the ancestors. We drink and feel the liquid travelling through all those pockets of ordinary trauma lodged under our skins, suspended
from... Oh dear, people think trauma is exceptional. The terrorist attack, the fallout from a bomb blast, blood on the streets. People do not see the ritual implosions, how every day you are trying not to explode, not to spill. I pour the tea into cups, one for each of us, and an extra one that is cracked, that leaks and spills for the ancestors. We drink and feel the liquid travelling through all these pockets of ordinary trauma lodged under our skins, suspended from time, in time, unheard, unheld, quiet, but not sleeping. Pockets with ears to hear when their own stories emerge from another woman's mouth. They recognise the words, they recognise the heartache, the fear and holding on, the strength, the softness, the truth housed in the body next door. Tongues loosened on sorrel and ginger dance, brood in sacred space, share stories, music, breath, tears, exchange traditional technologies of healing. Protection, eyes meet eyes in connection,
reconciliation.
And togetherness.
Another tea to live by. Together we are less afraid to tell and to be and to love and to spill.
So my name is Elia Messiah, and I'm an artist in Copenhagen, and I just graduated from the Art Academy. And I was at the workshop in November. That's almost a year ago. Yeah, and in Bergen, at my graduation show. I've just been building off how to actually just have a country with all its beautiful assets, like a national uniform or flags, a new national anthem. It's all fictional, but building these imaginary roots, but not down, but up into paradise. So my nation's name is Ilayin, and it means the people of paradise. There's no citizenship, there's no ownership. You can declare yourself part of the nation. at any time you want. It's not located anywhere, because this old nation, this one, is infected by a virus, and we don't want that back home. So I made this whole screening and decontamination center, fictional trucks and postal service, where I had this letter written from the nation. We the people think that you should consider how you are living in this nation and change your behavior. This nation, they hate you for criticizing it, while if you criticize my nation, I would be taking it as a constructive way. I would understand why they criticize my new flag that only says alchemy and poetry. But that's what I wanted to say, but I can explain why. Just sit with me. But I think these old nations can't handle criticism whatsoever. And they are so, in Danish, it's stupt. It's a really good word. It means that you can't mold it. When there's something so big that has to do with emotional and individuals and family, when you can't mold that, when you can't change anything, it becomes so dangerous. It just becomes so dark. And you can't really let any lights in, because you just covered it up with all these beliefs and this old used language. We need a new way of communicating with each other. This language between us here in Denmark especially is so dangerous, because you can't say to them, hey, but I feel like you could do better. But they think that they've done their best. Being in the workshop where we had to write something and read it out loud to the others, that was the first time for me. And I just took it as a challenge in some way. Ever since then, I've been reading my poetry, actually. I'm really bad at reading out loud, but I'm trying to maybe borrow a voice from an ancestor or two or something, but I don't know. Yeah. I'm trying to figure it out, but I've been writing ever since.
So yeah, I love Elia's idea of the new nation with the new language, and as a way to try to work with the constraints of this old language. How do we navigate this, these tight spaces? It was really interesting to hear people using different languages, speaking Norwegian, speaking in Spanish, speaking in English. And I think it's often a sight of the what Elia's talking about, the kind of setness, rigidness of things, can often sometimes live in language. You're coming to our country, you need to speak our language, and you need to speak it in this particular way. So all the moving, all the moulding has to be done by you. But the country, and that's kind of what she's saying, isn't it, can't change. You can come, but none of this is going to be at all responsive to your critique, to your experience, to your story, in fact, or to the languages you bring. And of course, there were a few younger women who had either been born in Norway or, been there for a very long time, who were fluent and could do that. And spoke, I think, of the kind of sadness of what had to become rigid in a way in them, what has to be set in a particular shape, and the loss of that, that what you lose when you have to fix yourself to fit in.
I really hear what you're saying there. I feel like it's kind of also part of this whole project. What you're describing there is exactly what this project is, right? We might work with art spaces, and I think we always challenge the art space whenever we've worked in the art spaces. We work in art spaces that perceive themselves to have a flexibility, particularly because it's a space that is forever changing. But the form always stays the same, right? The form, the building, when we're entering spaces that have never really been made for us. I mean, whether that be the university, the art space, this country, these nations, they were kind of constructed in particular ways. They never thought that we would be there, you know, we would ever be present within these nations. They have to reform in a different way. I mean, I'm not really liking the idea of just like reform, but they have to reform themselves. And this reforming is very uncomfortable for these, but it takes a really long time. So I'm really interested when Daniela and Mechu talk about their children. Daniela speaks about, you know, the mother tongue is Norwegian. It's not Spanish. Those children are the people that should be shaping this reforming of this place with its perceived openness, are not able to do that. They are, through schooling or whatever, indoctrinated into the setness that, you know, that Elia's speaking about, the kind of bestut, that there is little space to breathe and to change that.
My name is Daniela Ramos Arias. I'm from Costa Rica, but I've lived in Norway for the last almost 14 years. I am a curator with a focus in art mediation practices. I came here because I met a guy in Costa Rica, so my husband is from Bergen, which is where I am. We became good friends and together, and then I'm here. 14 years after, I have two kids, and our children are the result of two cultures that live in Norway with very little access to Spanish as the second language, because it is the second language, it's not the mother tongue. My children sometimes complain about the way that I show my passion. It sometimes looks as I am angry, but I'm not. I'm just frustrated and I express it the way that I see at least my husband. I'm not going to speak for all of the population, but he's way more paused and pedagogical. And I'm more like this typical Latin American woman that, you know, you want to say what you say, and that's how it is. And you do not complain about it because I'm your mom. Are you just going to listen to me right now? I do not want to discuss this. Like more recently, after the Declaration of Independence, because this is something that happens more now as my kids grow. They are in a school which is mostly white. There is one black girl in the class for my daughter who has experienced name calling. And then I am the one that goes there and fights with everyone and says, why is this happening? What are you doing to change this? And I feel like everyone here is so suppressed and they're like letting things go. It's gonna get fixed. No, it's not gonna get fixed. We're gonna fix it. I feel like I've been getting more and more and more and more angry the last months, especially after the Black Lives Matter and everything that has happened this year. But all this that has happened and made everyone a bit more aware here in Norway of racism that exists and has been quieted down or has been ignored has just been piling up and making me more and more angry and more feeling more like I have a responsibility to do something, because I am in a platform and a position of power now where I can do things and I can use my background and my position to be able to facilitate. Something started with the Declaration of Independence, but also there has been world events and local events that have made that this is even more relevant and visible right now than when you came here. It was more quiet. Now it's not as quiet anymore.
So within this performance, I suppose, when we kind of burst out in ways of the walls, burst in and, you know, become giants and invite ancestors in and all of this kind of stuff, it causes a very kind of interesting disruption. When you kind of hear of Daniela speaking about her children or her daughter in the daughter's class, you know, you just really hope it will change, but it's not sounding like it, because the young black child in her daughter's class, you know, is many black children in their classes at this moment experiencing exactly the same thing, with no teacher making any accountability for this problem, this situation where this child's kind of self-esteem is being diminished on a daily basis.
I have to big up Barbie and the kind of community building nature of this project, because of course after Bergen we've still got our WhatsApp group. And so we get to see how people are connecting. And I can feel the part of me that wants to be there joining them, but can kind of live vicariously through that, can really get pleasure from seeing that thing made and seeing how it lives a life and continues. And of course, I've seen that in the projects we've done here as well, you know, really living communities. It's not just about a weekend of workshops or a performance. It's about what can be built, what can be made. And I don't really like the word nation, honestly. You know, it's troubling in lots of ways. But if we think about the nation that's not located anywhere, Aaliyah's phrase, then that kind of building, that kind of community building that's happening, well, I mean, globally now, isn't it? Because it's involved so many women from so many different places.
Yeah, and the project has involved women who are connected to different places, but also are in different places. In 2017, when I first started speaking to people, there were women in Switzerland, Amsterdam, Brisbane, but they were not in Brisbane at that time. They were in the Seychelles. Martinique, you know, as well as London. I love the title of Lisa Lowe's books, The Intimacy of Four Continents, which actually talks about coloniality and how everyone is connected, but our connection is through the dialogues. And sometimes they're very small, you know, kind of small offerings. I'm thinking, you know, a prayer that came from a friend in New Zealand that, you know, was contributed to the Baltic Declaration of Independence, but, you know, and how that gets taken into Bergen and we listen to that, and that also brings some sort of resonances into the space, and that goes on in the ways in which these women are creating their own, you know, be it their own work like Aaliyah and writing poetry and, you know, sharing that with people, or in the kind of ways in which they're working independently in their work, but also the ways in which they're collaborating.
If I have a hope, it's not so much that things will be completely different, but that as we spiral, I think of us as kind of spiraling in time, we find ourselves in different places on the loop and more resourced perhaps to respond to and manage some of what we know. But in a way, if we don't find ways to, as our good friend Gail Lewis says, you know, take steerage from the past as we're navigating towards the future, then we're not resourced. What kind of steerage do we want to offer here? What can we make and produce and talk about as we are now that will be of use to people when perhaps they do come around to this same point again and we have to think about this child in her class again? Yeah, that's where I kind of get my hope from, if you like, thinking about resource. How to resource something, because it is easy to feel a bit powerless about 71 million people, what they did last week or the week before, you know, voted for a particular set of conditions. 71 million people thought this was a good idea. So I can't be that hopeful about certain things changing. But I can be more hopeful, I think, about what black women are doing. I'm going to say it. I'm just going to speak it. What black women are doing, what we are bringing together, what we are making possible by bringing ourselves into space and bringing together. If that helps me maintain my energy, that's where I'm going to spend my time. You know.
I didn't know I was identity confused until people told me. I didn't know I was brown until people told me. My siblings didn't know I was brown until people told me or told them. It took some time realizing that I'm a minority. My mother is not a minority. She has not been questioned on the basis of her brownness in this life. My experience is different from my mother's, my grandmother's. They have faced discrimination and prejudice too, in other ways. In other forms, as single mothers, sole providers, full-time matriarchs. It's still hard, but less frowned upon. Our world changes. We change it. I, a foreigner, always, everywhere, how dare I love myself, my soul and being. I must admit this world is a rough one. How dare I be so ungrateful?
Thank you to all the women who have been part of the Declaration of Independence in Bergen. Thank you in particular to Anine, Devon, Danielle, Elia and Mechu for sharing their stories and experiences for this podcast. A huge thank you to Maria Rusinovskaya for more than facilitation, for more than creating space, and for her unending generosity and dedication towards making this happen and supporting this process. Also, thank you to Scott Elliott and the team at Bergen Kunsthal. This podcast has been made possible by funding from Reimagine Europe. Thank you to Faluke Taylor, who has been an integral collaborator in the growth of Declaration of Independence since 2018. This podcast has been produced in collaboration with Femi Oriogun Williams. Thank you for listening.